appreciate you being here. We're in the discussion of the letters to the churches of Asia. As Brother West points out in his little commentary on Revelation, all of these seven congregations are in what we would call Asia Minor. And today it's modern Turkey. Each one of these congregations is somewhere in our modern nation of Turkey. They're not all that far from each other. And the second church, it's about 40 miles or so from Ephesus, west, northwest, a little ways. And each one of these congregations, if there is a difficulty that it's having, it's mentioned in the letter. Sometimes not with a whole lot of detail, and sometimes with more. Ephesus, the problem that she was having was primarily a spiritual problem. She had left her first love. And that was the criticism that God had of that congregation. Though she was doing a lot of wonderful things, but she just didn't feel about God as she once did. We're supposed to be growing in love, and she hadn't done that. Come in. Good to see you all. Smyrna, when you read through the church, the letter to the churches of Smyrna, you can tell by what is said there that she has financial difficulty. She's a poor congregation, very poor. A financial problem. She's also got a spiritual problem, and she's got a political problem because of what's going on or what is about to happen in the persecution. Thyatira, her problem is basically spiritual. Sardis is spiritual. Philadelphia is spiritual. And Laodicea is spiritual. If they have any difficulty at all, these are the way that I would sort of classify them. Now, you have two times when Jews are mentioned that are a synagogue of Satan. Now, they could also be causing political trouble. But we'll start at least with a spiritual confrontation with them over the gospel, over the truth. And so that's why I list that the way that I do. Now, last time, we talked about verse 10 and how that you have several things described here. Fear not the things that thou art about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison, that you may be tried. And ye shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee the crown of life. And so you have the source of the trouble. The Lord tells the congregation, the devil is behind this. The devil is about to cast some of you into prison. The scope of it, we said, was partial. Not all of you are going to prison. Only some of you. But then that brings about, a change in the congregation. And then some people wonder, well, why me and not her? Why her and not me? Why did this happen to that family and it didn't happen to mine? You got the same sort of questions that come up today when somebody is hurting or suffering or somebody died in a wreck or whatever. The same kinds of questions, Well, why was he taken? Why not me? And so you have to work through all of those things in your congregations. And then the purpose, that you may be tried. A purpose, that you may be tried. Come in. Now, James will tell us about the trial. The trial is from God's viewpoint. The temptation is from the devil's viewpoint. Thou shalt have tribulation 10 days. Good to see you all. Trial of the same scene, the same event, the same experience. God is looking at it. I hope you come through this. I hope you get better because of it. And the devil is saying, man, I hope this destroys you. That's the difference between a trial and a test. A trial and a temptation. The devil is always, to the degree of his involvement, he wants you to collapse. God is saying in His Word and in His providence, I'm pulling for you. I want you to come through this. Just like Job. I've got all the confidence in the world in Job. There's nobody like him on the earth. I want you to succeed. But he says, as far as you're concerned, of course, it is a test. And you can say the whole thing about life. My life is a test. A test. How good are you with tests? Say, well, the ones I took in school, I wasn't so sharp on sometimes. Depend on how much I studied, how much I learned. But what about the life's test? Okay, so you've got the purpose of it. It's a trial. The nature of it, it's tribulation, affliction. It's hardship. The duration of it, it's temporary. And then here's the obligation. Your job is not necessarily to philosophically unravel all of the integrated features of the reality of the moment. Your job is to pass through it with complete faith in God. That's your job. Be thou faithful until death. And then you've got a reward. And I will give thee the crown of life. And I take that to be the crown, which is life. It's certainly not going to be, though it's the word would indicate, you know, reward, victory. But the reward is eternal life. Romans 6 and verse 23. That's the crown. All right, so in the 10 days, it's just like Revelation 20, the 1,000 years. This shows you that it's limited. It's limited. A period of time. It's not going to last forever. It's not going to last forever. And that's one thing that gives us great comfort in life. A lot of times when we are agonizing over certain things, this is temporary. Sometimes we want things to last a long time because it feels so good. It's such a joy. I think I told you about a horse trainer I know. Used to be with him up in Wellington. He got to a point in his life, his son had grown up where he could help him, you know, and everything was just going just like he wanted. He said, I wish I could just stop time. I mean, he wanted it to stay the way. Now, of course, if you think about that in your more reflective moments, he would want his boy to go on and grow up and get married and have kids and all that. But just as far as the personal environment right now, just the thrill of it and the joy of it, this is just great. This is just great. But those moments pass. And then another one and another one. And shortly, life passes by. Two. So, the crown of life awaits you. Be thou faithful. And he that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith to the churches. He that overcometh. In every letter, you've got to overcome. It's not an automatic thing, and some people do collapse in difficulty. They do not turn to God. They do not read His Word. They do not come to understand the principles that can give peace and happiness and strength. Life is not heaven on earth. Life on earth is not heaven. It's not supposed to be. In chapter 3 and verse 21, in another letter, Jesus will say, now you've got to overcome just like I overcame. Now he just does that one time in the seven letters. But he says, I overcame. Now, you've got to follow me. You have to overcome too. So, it's not necessarily so easy in all regards. And as I continually say, if you don't overcome, then you undergo. You undergo punishment. And the punishment here that he mentions specifically, if you overcome, you shall not be heard of the second death. Now, isn't that an unusual expression? The second death. Well, so there was a first one. There was a first death, which seems to be a combination of the features of the physical and the spiritual death, because we die physically now, whether we die spiritually or not. Little children sometimes pass away. But we all die physically because of Adam. We die spiritually because of our own sins. So, but you put those in combination, this whole experience, you know, how death entered the world through Adam, Romans 5, 12 through 14. So you put them all together, the physical death that came because he lost access to the tree of life, and the spiritual death that accrues to a heart that commits sin, and Paul said in Romans 3:23, up till about 58 AD, that includes everybody, all of sin, falling short of the glory of God. So we're going to just put that together as the first death. That is, you die spiritually and you die physically. And the spiritual death, of course, is the main consideration there, because that's when you lose fellowship with God. But then when you get recovered by the gospel, forgiven, forgiveness of sins, regeneration, indwelling, all of that, and then you're on the way to heaven. But if you apostatize, or if you never become a Christian, then you shall be heard of the second death. And the second death is far more serious in the sense that there is no end to it. Regarding the first death, you can have forgiveness of sins. Regarding the physical aspect of it, you can have the resurrection. But you think about the second death, separation from God forever and ever and ever and ever, and there's no end to that. That's why that is so extraordinarily serious. Chapter 20, go over to chapter 20. Revelation 20 and verse 6. Blessed and holy is he that hath part in the first resurrection. So you can have a first death and a second death, and you can have a first resurrection and the second resurrection. Now, my first resurrection was, of course, when I think about this passage, Romans 6, 3 and 4. Know ye not, as many of us as were baptized into Christ were baptized into his death. We were buried therefore with him through baptism into death. That as Christ was raised from the glory of the Father, even so we also should walk in newness of life. When you came up from the water, having been forgiven, regenerated, and indwelled, you come up to new life. That's a resurrection. Isn't that interesting? Blessed and holy is he that hath part in the first resurrection. Isn't that amazing? Over these, the second death hath no power. But they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. Now that's going on right now. It's a limited time, because life on earth is limited. We just are here for a little while. But at any rate, so now we come to Pergamum, another church in Asia. Brother West points out that it's an important town. In its day, it was like Alexandria, Egypt, in the sense that it had a great library. A great library. And it has the second largest library in the world. It's right here in Pergamum, or Pergamus. The word means citadel. Now, we'll see, of course, that there are problems here because of persecution, because of false doctrine, because Satan's attention has been on this town. Certain things have been done. There's a cult worship here. Caesar is, in fact, worshipped here. There is an altar to the Greek and Roman god Zeus in this town. And so you imagine being a member of the church in Pergamum, and you'll see it on the street out there, the altar where there's worship to Zeus, and there's a temple to Caesar. So you worship Caesar. That's what this book is about: putting God first, or caving into Roman authority and worshiping Caesar. Now, just think about this. Now, we're talking about persecution and death. Be thou faithful unto death. We've had a little slight thing that happened here recently in America over this disease. And we had to sort of shut down for a little while. Did you know that we've had controversy in the church over that? And we've had one or two very vocal people in the church. You people that are closing your doors and not worshiping, that's wrong. And I wrote an article weeks ago now, and sent it to several people, but where I explained why we have every right to do what our government is asking us to do. Now, they're not persecuting us. And if we thought it was, then we couldn't worship, I would defy that too. Now, if you get beyond the initial danger of the health scare, I've got a right to protect my health, and so do you. In fact, I want you to help me protect my good to have doctors and nurses and all of that. And we want that, and we're supposed to. But anyway, there are various principles. I'm not going to go over it again. I did it in an earlier lesson. When June and I were over here by ourselves, I think one Sunday, and I recorded it, and I put the lesson on. But anyway, we've had criticizing systems, but that wasn't persecution of the church. Now, we seem to be entering a second stage where in some states, there may be some public officials that are taking advantage of the health issue to impose their will as a subtle attack against religion. Now, if I was involved in that sort of thing, you know, I kind of look at it differently than just trying to keep everybody healthy and not having people die from a disease. That's sort of a different thing. But over here, you see, we still have the freedom to march and protest and you know, all of that. And most people don't have that. I'll read a little bit from Philip Gunther's report here. When I make the announcements, you know, he tells how many students they've lost to death, religious persecution in the Middle East, and how many were attacked that lived. And yet he will say, nobody has given up. Nobody's quit. And ours wasn't even a persecution. Now, we got to worship, and now we're coming back and all of that, but And tomorrow is Memorial Day, and we honor all of those that have given their lives for our freedom. You sit back and you think about that. What an enormous price was paid that we could just do this, and be free. Most people don't have the freedom that we have. I had an uncle, I was told this years and years ago, my uncle Jesse Edgar Gibson, my mother's brother, he crawled out of 5 tanks in World War II that were hit, either demolished or immobilized. 5 tanks. And I think I mentioned to you that one day he got a letter. He was inside one of these tanks, and he got a letter from home. And he hadn't had time, I guess, to open it. And anyway, in there, all of a sudden, he opened the letter, and something fell out. And he bent over to pick it up, and just at that time, some sort of bullet came through right where he had been. And it was some money. And he kept it for years because that little, would you call it an accident? Or maybe somehow it was in the providence of God. What do you think? Well, I couldn't know for sure. I like to think it's a part of the providence of God. But at any rate, we are enormously grateful for people that have lived and given their lives for our freedom. And what about all of those that gave their lives for the gospel, which gives you the greatest freedom, whether you live in America or over in Saudi Arabia or Dubai or the Philippines? The greatest freedom you can have. And people have already died, and some in our day, that the gospel might continue. He that overcometh shall not be heard of the second death. All right, now, and to the angel of the church in Pergamum write, these things saith he that hath the sharp two-edged sword. Back in chapter 1, verse 16, this image of Jesus that John saw, this sword was coming out of the mouth of Jesus. Hebrews 4, now we'll have the picture of God's word as being powerful. It's sharp. It's more powerful than any two-edged sword. More than any two-edged sword. If you want to just compare things, you got your sword? Yeah, that's quite a weapon. This is an altogether different kind of weapon, but it's far more important than that one. And it can do for you what that one can't possibly do. Each has its place in the divine arsenal of protection and the advancement of value. But that one can only do so much. This one can take you to glory. I commend you to God and to the word of His grace. which is able to build you up and give you an inheritance among all them that are sanctified. I believe that. I believe that. The Word, it's just so fascinatingly important and thorough and complete in what it can do. So, Jesus has the sword. Jesus is writing the letter to the angel or the messenger of the church. He'll deliver this letter to Pergamum. These messengers are not named. But Jesus has the sharp, two-edged sword. I know where thou dwellest, where Satan's throne is. Man alive. Now that ought to put, if you don't have any fear already, reading that in services one day, the messenger reads this letter, we live where Satan's throne is. We knew we had problems. We knew there was a bunch of idolatry and sin around, and we know that Zeus is worshipped and Caesar, and we knew that we were under pressure. But my goodness, I haven't thought about it quite like Satan lives here too. Satan's got a throne here. He sits enthroned right here in my town. That's one way of looking at it, because of the extreme degree of his influence. Now, the devil has a lot of influence. 1 John 5:19. The whole world lies in the evil one. I'd say that's a massive amount of influence. But at any given moment, the expression, the overt expression of his will may not be as intense as it is in some other town, some other place. We've all had experiences. And maybe we've lived in some other towns. And we've been in some other congregations. And we've had to deal with the difficulties that those congregations faced. And they're not all equal. They're not all the same. Just looking back over your life, you know, I said, boy, some of my happiest moments are right there. Maybe some of the greatest conflict was right there. I remember that. I remember how I felt. You remember your feelings? A lot of times you can. You remember your feelings, how it was at that time, at that moment, and that controversy. Well, I'm simply saying that the influence of the devil is not always equally expressed from town to town or place or country to country. But he's living right now. He's sitting on a throne in Pergamum, and yet you're holding on. You're holding on. Now, I know where you dwell, and I know where he dwells. And thou holdest fast my name. You hold fast my name. You clasp it. You're grasping it. My name. You hold fast my name. And didst not deny my faith. Even in the days of Antipas, my witness, my faithful one, who was killed among you, where Satan dwelt. Now, Satan's power reached to that degree. It was a member of the church that lost his life one day because of the devil. Now remember, Smyrna is about to face a persecution. 10 days, limited. About. Some of them are going to go to prison. Some of them aren't. But some of them are. But here, there's a historical note with regard to experience through which you've already passed. And God says, I saw that. I watched that. I was with you in that. And we don't know any, there's nothing, as far as I know, extra-biblically about Antipas. But he was noteworthy in the mind of God to have his name registered in the Bible. Isn't that something? Now, several people, you'll have their names and some descriptions, sometimes some reports of experiences. You'll have a few about which a lot is said. And then sometimes you just have a name. And then sometimes you don't even have that. People are in a group and they experience something, but no names are given. Wouldn't it be something on the other side to be Antipas? We can talk to him on the other side. You're Antipas? We studied about you. Didn't know much about you, but I'll tell you this. We were impressed with your fidelity, your courage. And we read about you in Pergamum. And having all the problems that the church did because of its environment in Rome, under the influence of Rome, and how that the devil used that to destroy the church. And he reached in and grabbed you and killed you. And then God later talks about that. And when that happened, you people held on. See, because it's not automatic. When you get the idea that somebody's looking at you, you know, it's a different thing. And especially be somebody that's a threat. When somebody that is a threat poses a risk to my future, my being on the earth, my life, that's a different sort of thing. Come in, come in. And so he says, when Antipas was killed, you held on. Come in, fellas. Good to have you all. Revelation chapter 2 and verse 13. And so when Antipas was killed, you did not deny my faith. You did not deny my faith. Even right there where you live and right there where Satan dwells. So, there have been members of the church who have been able, because of their love of the gospel, their knowledge of the truth, that they would not give up for anything. That's the way I've got to be. That's the way you have to be, regardless of our circumstances and the change in them. The change in me must always be up. It must be forward. It must be getting better, getting more knowledge, getting more wisdom, getting more strength, getting more courage, more faith, more love, more steadfastness. It's always in the advance. Now, that's not automatic, but we try to help each other all the time. We try to make sure that we're going forward so that if there is a change in circumstance, we'll hold on. We'll be faithful. Antipas was killed. But then after that great history, and again, when you go through these letters and you see the compliments, I mean, the word compliment almost sounds like an insult because it's not good enough. When you're describing somebody who gave his life for the cause, just a compliment. It's not simply a compliment. But here you've got divine approval. You've got divine endorsement. Divine favor. That's far superior to any human compliment I can give to somebody. It's just, it beggars language in a way. But I have a few things against thee. Lord, how can there be anything against us when we stood our ground and then Antipas even died? Well, there's some problems right now in the local church. And they're not being dealt with. Well, you might say, is it possible that if a congregation has a superior past, that it's allowed an inferior present? Do you read a passage in Scripture where God ever gives that point as a principle? If you have a superior past and you went through the fire for me and I saw that and I favored that and I was all for that, and then right now you weaken and you start not dealing with internal problems, so that the congregation is going to get weak and it's going to, you know, disintegrate. But you say, yeah, but you remember back then when we stood up? Yeah, I remember that. I remember that. Can you go to heaven simply on your past when you don't have a present? Now, if you have a past and a present, wonderful. If you don't have a past but you have a present, wonderful. You can have a bad past and turn on that and have a present. But the past is not going to help us if we turn our hearts away. And then, like those in Matthew 7:21, say, Lord, I did this and I did that and I did that. And Jesus says to these people, well, I never knew you. You never were even in the kingdom. Well, we cast out demons. We did many mighty works. Depart from me, ye that work iniquity. But they talked about their past. They interpreted it falsely. They did not understand their past. They misrepresented their past. But here, you can have a real accurate representation of a good past. But now, what's going on now? So as our circumstances change, we have to meet the moment. We have to be wise and faithful and strong, always oriented toward the truth and walking in truth and applying truth so that we're not subtly overcome or we're not, you know, obviously overcome. We hold our ground. And that's not an easy thing in congregations because it sometimes entails confrontations. I have a few things against thee because thou hast there some that hold the teaching of Balaam. The teaching of Balaam. You know, the Bible is very interesting. Some walk in the way of Cain. Some hold the teaching of Balaam, drawing on Old Testament history that God chronicled for us in His Word. Amazing how the tie is there, historically and literarily. Thou hast there some that hold the teaching of Balaam. Numbers 22 through 24, Balak, King Balak, Moab wanted Balaam to curse the Israelites. They were coming and encroaching on his territory, and well, man. And Balaam evidently had some connection to divine power. And Balak knew it. And so these people need to be stopped. I want you to come over here and curse them. And you remember how it is. Every time he opens his mouth, first of all, God doesn't want him to go. Tries to stop him. Remember that. But anyway, once God finally says, okay, go on, but you can only say what I say. And so Balak wants him to curse, and he opens his mouth, and blessings come out. Well, that doesn't sit well. Let's change locations. Maybe it has to do with location, but it's not location. And he just keeps on opening his mouth, and he keeps on blessing them. Well, my goodness, don't say anything if you're just going to do that. But finally, Balaam says, now look, if you'll get Israel to sin, you don't need me. God will curse them himself. And so that's what they tried. That's what they tried. Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel to eat things sacrificed to idols and to commit fornication. Now, you've heard me say over and over again that sexuality is an instrument of great value and dignity and worth and pleasure and all of that. But it's also an instrument, it's a vehicle of great destruction. Great destruction, historically. And the Bible will give us various accounts of how that works. So if you get somebody to commit fornication, well, God will take care of those people. In 1 Corinthians 10, Paul will even, look at this, Paul will refer to something right here in 1 Corinthians 10, and he's warning the church at Corinth, don't be like sinners. God gave us an example of His own people turning into sinners. And neither be ye idolaters, verse 7, as some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Neither let us commit fornication, Numbers 25:9, as some of them committed, and fell in one day, 20,000. He said, don't be like that. Don't do that. But the devil knows how to change minds and to make an appeal. If there's some way to distort a Bible doctrine and to change it so that you're allowed to commit sin in harmony with it, somebody will try that. And it has been tried. It has been tried. And it's a sad thing to have to even think about that. To commit fornication, so hast thou also some. See, why aren't you people dealing with those in the church that are doing that? Now, we have had cases in the church in Texas where there's been fornication. And we've had preachers involved in it and secretaries. And I know of one case where I think it was an elder. And he never, in this particular case, this is long, long ago, before even some of you were born. You don't know any of these people. Don't be guessing. But anyway, in this particular case, I mean, the local preacher knew that this fella was committing adultery. But he could not get, I guess you could say, empirical evidence on him. And the fella would not admit it. And so the preacher says this, and he says, no, it's not that way. And the preacher knows that it's that way, but he doesn't. It's just like going into court. You don't have any evidence like that to take in there. And the fellow, there are plenty of people, now some under pressure will say, I was wrong. I know what I did wrong and I'm sorry. I know that. And there are people that will not, as a matter of pride or whatever it is, they will never. And they're going to lose their souls over things like that. You've got pride like that, you can't get into heaven. You've got to humble yourself and admit sin. We had a case where I was years ago, and this was a young fellow. Wound up in the hospital. Sins can make you sick. You know that. Sins can make you sick. Now, you get sick otherwise too, but sins can do it. And he wound up in the hospital. And when I went to see him, instead of just admitting his situation, which we understood and knew, no. And he starts casting blame on everybody else around him. Everybody, you know, he said, everybody's against me. Now, he was the one that had been unfaithful to his wife. And now all of a sudden, the rest of us are at fault. How does that work exactly? How does that work? But I tell you what, we humans are something else because we've got the capacity to imagine situations like that. Don't talk to me about my problem or my sin. You're the ones that are wrong. You've got the wrong attitude. Wrong attitude? What about your deed? And what if our attitudes are not wrong? Your deed is. Whether our attitudes are wrong or not. That's wrong. But we have a way of rewriting history and reinterpreting the scene. And I tell you, our capacity for self-justification is something to behold. And then to blame somebody else for the way I am. You're all against me. That makes sense at bottom, rock bottom. And so you people, you've got somebody in the church that's influencing others to commit fornication, to eat things sacrificed to idols. You're not doing anything about it. Now, if a preacher comes in and exposes it, you can fire him. I wonder how many times that's happened. You can get rid of the fellow that's just drifting through. Do you want the truth? Do you want the candlestick to stay in place? Do you want to go to heaven more than anything? Or is it a matter of just getting along? Making a joke of the gospel in the church? That's what it becomes in places at certain times in history. So hast thou also some that hold the teaching of the Nicolaitans in like manner. And as I say, that's very obscure. As far as any extra-biblical material, let's suppose there was a man named Nicholas that advocated something sort of like the teaching of Balaam. It liberalized people, it let them do things that the Bible does not let them do. In our day, you know, some members of the church might say, well, we're moderns. We're sophisticated. We can handle sin. We can handle certain situations, and it's not going to affect us the way it does others. We toy with ourselves about things like that. And so God says, you people, you congregation, you need to repent. Repent therefore, else I come to thee quickly, and I will make war against them with the sword of my mouth. We'll stop right there and come back to this.
The Nicolaitans, kind of like once they always say type of
deal. It kind of sounds like it, doesn't it? In fact, this morning on the search program, Phil was talking about that very issue, once saved, always saved. And it's a sad mistake to make. And I had a preacher friend just a few weeks ago, after all of his, he's still a young fellow, but after all of his experience in his work in the kingdom, he decided that doctrine's true. Sad. People still fall into that error who have some Bible knowledge. Thank you much for your kindness. Good to have our visitors with us. We're not going to shake hands this morning. We're trying to... Are you going to some work for me?
Very best. I've always seen that calendar. They're not walking. They were hoping some were in the cell, but I'm not that role. And I'll be like, shoot me in. I never saw her again.
Well, because we didn't know if we were going to camp out somewhere else. And we were going to do so. But we, but